Welcome to According to Sam, folks. This is episode 202. Thank you for joining me today. I have a really good podcast for you guys today. I'm going to stop, planning on what I'm going to do in these shows and just take it as it comes. Today, we're going to take a little bit of a detour and talk about the economy. And then we're going to get back into, hopefully, again, I'm not going to even plan on what we'll talk about on Monday. We'll just see what happens over on Monday, because as we're getting to the end of spring and begin to get into the summer, things are going to be happening so fast as we get close to the election. So I'm not going to plan on what I'm going to be presenting to you guys. I'm going to just, as I'm led and as I feel that I need to address topics, then I'm going to address those topics. And I promise you it's going to be interesting. I hope you guys have been enjoying the show so far this year. Again, today we're going to talk about the economy. Let's get right into it. We're going to pick up, though. I want to start with the farewell address. We were talking about that last week of Dwight Eisenhower. In 1961, he gave this address 3 days before John Kennedy was sworn in, and he was not going to be president anymore. He was leaving public life forever. He was retiring, and this was his address that he gave to the American people. This is the beginning of television. So no one else had really given a farewell address like this, televised farewell address. I guess it had been done on the radio before. And like we were talking about George Washington, he wrote his farewell address out. But this was the first time that that television was used, and this address was beamed into the living rooms of the American people. There's a lot in this address. It's 15 minutes long. He says a lot, but the most important part of this address, and the part of this address that has gotten the most attention over the last, 70 years now, has been his warning about the military-industrial complex seizing power through influence of government. And let's listen to him say this again, and we'll get started with today's podcast with Dwight Eisenhower here. Take a listen.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals.
So he gives that warning, and then he says, only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing between the defense industry and our peaceful aims and ambitions. That he says in the beginning, that we are religious people, and as a religious people, that we strive for peace and human betterment. He says that only an alert and knowledgeable people can compel, can weigh that balance between needing a permanent armaments industry and our religious ambitions for peace and human betterment. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry. Are we an alert and knowledgeable citizenry? That's the question that I ask. Are we an alert and knowledgeable citizenry. And if we're not an alert and knowledgeable citizenry, then are we at danger of being overrun by not only the military industrial complex, but technological elite. He calls them a scientific and technological elite. That's what he calls them, a scientific and technological elite, Dwight Eisenhower says. So are we the slaves and being manipulated by this scientific and technological elite, or are we an alert and knowledgeable citizenry? I think that's a question to be pondered. So like I said, we're going to start talking about the economy today. We'll get back into Eisenhower. We're going to talk a little bit about Nixon today, but we're going to talk more about Nixon probably on Monday. But new economic numbers came out on Wednesday, and they were reporting on inflation, on wages, everything from the month of March and the end of the first quarter of 2024. We got those numbers on Wednesday, and they were not good. Take a listen to this clip.
Now to some breaking news. Wall Street took a hit, with all three major indexes finishing the day in the red. The Dow fell more than 400 points after the Labor Department reported a higher-than-expected spike in inflation. The consumer price index for March rose at an annual rate of 3.5%, and that is the biggest jump in 6 months. In tonight's Money Watch, CBS's Jolene Kent shows us how consumers are feeling the pinch.
For the third straight month, prices have gone up more than expected, from the rising cost of car insurance and repairs to how much you're paying at the grocery store every week.
Do you know how much one of these costs? Two freaking dollars.
This was $200.
We supposed to skip the power bill this month so we can buy groceries or the mortgage.
Before the pandemic, all of these groceries, about 30 items, cost $100 on average. Now, 5 years later, according to Nielsen IQ, all this costs 33% more, meaning you'd have to skip about 10 items, like chicken, bread, milk, and bananas.
No one's skipping anything.
$100 budget.
5 years ago versus today, the difference is remarkable. Is that normal?
Oh, goodness, it's not normal at all. So that's why really consumers are really, really scrutinizing their behaviors because, you know, prices are leveling off, but they're leveling off at these record high levels.
Higher gas prices and rent also helped push inflation up 3.5% over the last year. Also more expensive, baby food and formula spiking nearly 10%, elder care up over 14%, and veterinary care jumping almost 10%. President Biden responding today.
We're better situated than we were when we took office.
Now, this guy's such a liar. This guy is such a liar. We're better situated today than the day that he took office. That's a lie. That's an outright lie that we're not better situated today than the day that you took office at all.
Responding today.
We're better situated than we were when we took office, where inflation was skyrocketing.
Inflation wasn't skyrocketing when this guy took office. Inflation was not skyrocketing. Inflation didn't start skyrocketing until after one of the very first things that Biden did after being sworn in. He did a $2 trillion, $1.9 trillion pandemic relief package. This Senator Warner, Mark Warner of Virginia, is a Democrat. So he's in the same party as the president of the United States. He's a Democrat. And Senator Warner admitted that the $1.9 trillion pandemic relief package that Biden did when he first was sworn in, it was too big. Biden's $1.9 trillion pandemic relief package was too big, Senator Warner says. Now, he says that he doesn't say that it contributed to the inflation, but I'm going to show you how this absolutely contributed to the inflation. You can't just create $2 trillion out of thin air. You can't do it. And I'm going to show that to you today. I'm going to show you that you can't just create $2 trillion out of thin air and it not have an effect. I mean, these are basic economic principles. Yes, it was too big. The Biden did it with 50 votes, and the vice president was the tiebreaker, because if you remember, the Senate was 50-50 at this time. So Kamala Harris was the tie-breaking vote. Not a single Republican voted for this. Now, when they were negotiating this, Republicans wanted to negotiate, and they said, look, we'll do something smaller. We have a vaccine. The pandemic is basically over. We've already done all of this other COVID spending throughout 2020. It's time to lighten up on the spending. And Republicans wanted to negotiate. And the Republicans said that we'll do something that is around $500 billion. We'll do $500 billion. Democrats said, no, no deal. We don't want $500 billion. We want $2 trillion. So they did $2 trillion. And that's when the inflation started. That's when the inflation started, Joe Biden. Inflation wasn't skyrocketing when you were sworn in, you liar.
Skyrocketing. And we have a plan to deal with it.
But until then, shoppers continue to cut corners where they can.
We asked Americans, have you changed your behavior? And 87% of Americans have said yes to that. We may be seeing
changing that behavior for a lot of people is going out and getting a second job, which Joe Biden is touting as new job creation. A lot of that change of behavior is using your credit card more than what you were able to buy with your paycheck. So people are going into debt. So there's a lot of different ways that people are changing behaviors to deal with this increase in price.
We may be seeing more, you know, white meat on the barbecue than red meat this summer, because beef prices have gone up 9%. Everybody's been impacted by this. There's no way you can get around it.
The good news here is...
No, there's no good news. There's no good news at all. Let's listen to this. Is another report.
Latest reports on inflation show as of March, consumer prices are continuing to increase, which means interest rates are likely not to be cut.
So that's what it's all about, too, the interest rates. Let's see if I have the full Biden clip from. Look at that in a moment. This was the question that Biden was asked. I think they're in the Rose Garden with the ambassador, or not ambassador, the president of Japan. Take a listen.
Last month, you predicted the Federal Reserve would cut interest rates thanks to falling inflation. But today, data showed that inflation rose more than expected for the third straight month. So how concerned are you about the fight against inflation stalling? And do you stand by your prediction for a rate cut?
Well, I do stand by my prediction that before the year is out, there'll be a rate cut. This may delay it a month or so. I'm not sure of that. We don't know what the Fed is going to do for certain.
But hilarious.
We have dramatically reduced inflation from 9% down to close to 3%. We're in a situation where we're better situated than we were when we took office, where inflation was skyrocketing.
So it's all about those interest rates. That's what the focus is. And you understand that the question is, because interest rates are 8% right now. Honestly, the interest rates where they are right now, I'm going to show you that they're actually too low. Interest rates should be a lot higher than where they are. But check this out. This was Ro Khanna back in December. Let me expand this for you so you can see. This is what Ro Khanna said back in December. He tweeted this out. He tweeted out Paul Krugman talking about this issues. What does Paul Krugman say here? Okay, since a lot of this debate is happening here, going to temporarily return to Musk land. So I guess he's talking about the Twitter app. Aaron is completely right. Team Transitory predicted a positive supply shock as conditions normalize. I don't know who he's calling Team Transitory here. Maybe maybe Janet Yellen, because that's why I started laughing here when Biden says, well, I don't know what the Fed's going to do. Are you kidding me? Your Treasury Secretary came from the Fed, buddy. Janet Yellen was the chairman of the Fed. Then when he gets elected, he brings her over to the Treasury department. I think that's I can't think of another instance where something like that has happened, where the Federal Reserve has now. I mean, it's always been, you know, a tight relationship between the Treasury side. And then you've had all the Goldman Sachs Treasury secretaries too. Timothy Geithner came from the New York Fed to the Treasury. So I guess that's kind of the same thing. So, I mean, the Fed and the Treasury has always worked very closely together. I mean, doesn't matter if it's the Goldman Sachs guys or someone like Timothy Geithner. But to have someone like Yellen go directly from being the chairman at the Fed to being the Treasury Secretary, I mean, it's a joke for Joe Biden to say that he doesn't know what the Fed is going to do, like Janet Yellen and Jerome Powell are not communicating with each other. You would have to be stupid not to believe that Janet Yellen, who came from the Federal Reserve to the Treasury Department, is not communicating with the current Treasury Fed chair. So this is what Ro Khanna says back in December. Powell should cut interest rates now, given most inflation was caused by supply shocks. No, the inflation wasn't caused by the supply shocks, buddy. Stop lying to people. The inflation was caused by the creation of money. By creating new money is what caused the inflation. With no supply shocks, Powell should cut interest rates now, given most of inflation was caused by supply shocks. If he doesn't, he may be the person most responsible for the possible return of Donald Trump. Can you believe that? Can you believe that? That Ro Khanna is giving a political reason for Jerome Powell to cut interest rates? Because it's better politically for Joe Biden to cut interest rates. That's how we got in this mess with negative interest rates, with QE in the 2000 after 2008 crash. The Federal Reserve acting politically instead of responsibly. That's how we got in this mess. So I'm telling you that the Biden administration is putting pressure on Jerome Powell. I know for a fact that he is, through his Treasury Secretary. He's probably communicating with him on a daily basis, and they were trying to get him to cut the interest rates, like Ro Khanna said, for political reasons, because it'll help him in the election in November. But rates should be a lot higher because of the debt, because of the new money created. So now that we have these new numbers that came out on Wednesday, it's impossible for there to be a rate cut. And it would be very irresponsible for the Federal Reserve to cut rates when inflation hasn't gone down. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens leading up to the elections, because I don't believe that there's going to be a rate cut this year. Some people are predicting that he may raise the rates. And if he was acting responsibly, if Jerome Powell was acting responsibly and not politically, he most certainly would raise rates. And I'm going to show you why here in a moment.
Show as of March, consumer prices are continuing to increase, which means interest rates are likely not to be cut. 22 News reporter Christina Demores joins us live in studio after breaking down the numbers on where it's hitting us the hardest.
That's right. And I spoke with people locally who say inflation is still burning a hole through their wallet.
Of course it is.
The prices are definitely increasing, and the grocery bill that we have each week is going up and up and up. So, you know, things have been a little bit more challenging.
Inflated prices seem to be a never-ending challenge for consumers across the country and right here in the state. And there's no sign of it stopping, according to the latest Consumer Price Index.
Of course there's no sign of it stopping. There's no. They just passed a $2 trillion budget. Of course. There's not. I mean, no. If you don't stop this, right here, then no, you're not going to stop the inflation. So no, the inflation does not, it's not going to stop. Sorry.
Consumer price index beating expectations with a 3.5% increase as of March. Over the last 12 months, food prices have increased by about 2%, with meat, fish, poultry, and eggs continuing to climb. Energy also seeing increases. Gasoline is up by roughly 1%.
Energy and food from the grocery store, that's their little trick. That's not included in the core. When you hear people talking about CPI, Consumer Price Index, sometimes they just say CPI and they don't tell you that they're talking about core CPI. In the core CPI, the energy and food are not included in core CPI. And that's where you've seen the greatest rate of increase in prices in these places like energy and at the grocery store. And that's not included. So when you are reading articles or you hear people talking on TV about CPI, you need to do a little bit more investigate, because what Biden is doing here, they're playing little parlor tricks because they know the economy is not good, but they keep gaslighting people and they're trying to gaslight people and tell them, even though people are experiencing these high prices on a daily basis, you know, they're using data and fudging numbers and using special definitions that the people may not understand, like CPI and core CPI. And they're trying to play games on you. Like, and that's why, as Dwight Eisenhower says, that we need to be alert and we need to be knowledgeable, because these people are predators. Okay. And they've been preying on us for a long time. And I think now people are starting to become a little bit more alert. But now it's time to get knowledgeable as well. So core CPI numbers do not include food or energy, and that's where we've seen the largest the largest inflation happening in those two sectors.
Increased by about 2%, with meat, fish, poultry, and eggs continuing to climb. Energy also seeing increases. Gasoline is up by roughly 1%, and electricity at 5%. And as for shelter, it saw an increase of nearly 6%. Economic experts say because of the higher inflation, it is less likely that the Federal Reserve will cut interest rates anytime soon, impacting borrowers nationwide. According to economic reports, it was anticipated that the Federal Reserve would begin cutting interest rates this summer, but is now likely to be pushed into September.
September, right before the election, huh? There won't be any. I would be highly surprised if there's rate cuts in September. Again, I believe that they should be raising rates more because of this. This is the reason. This is the reason right here. We're getting ready to be $35 trillion in debt. So with debt like this, then yes, the interest rate needs to be higher, because you need to slow this down. You need to take money out of circulation, out of the system, because the amount of money in circulation, the amount of money that is out there is devaluing the money. Hold on. I don't want to get ahead of myself. I'm getting ready to break that down for you. This is a clip of all the things that the Biden administration has told us about inflation over the last 3.5 years that since he's been there, and why you would believe these people. I mean, it's on you at some point if you continue to believe these liars. These people are liars. Are you going to be an alert and knowledgeable person, are you going to continue to believe these liars? Take a listen.
I really doubt that we're going to see an inflationary cycle.
It will have a temporary or transitory impact.
The faster than expected increase in some of those prices is actually a good sign.
The overwhelming consensus is going to pop up a little bit and then go back down. No one's talking about this great, great deal.
This is something that will settle down.
Transitory.
Transitory.
Most of the price increases we've seen were expected.
And transitory.
Expected to be temporary. It's highly unlikely there's going to be long-term inflation that's going to get out of hand. I don't know anybody who's worried about inflation.
Over the last couple of months, we actually saw it trended downward.
President Biden's chief of staff, Ron Klain, enthusiastically retweeted an economist who had said, in part, most of the economic problems we're facing, inflation, supply chains, etc., are high-class problems.
Well, the number one thing that the president can do is help get COVID under control. That, we know, is the root cause of inflation.
President Biden this afternoon.
So COVID, listen to all the so let's go back here to McClain say supply chain issues, because these are all the reasons that they are telling their people. These are the reasons and excuses that they are giving and they've been giving for the past 3 years for inflation, that it was supply chain issues. So you hear, all of the Democrat, people that watch MSNBC all day and that have learned their talking points, you will hear them say that inflation is caused by supply chain issues, or inflation was caused by COVID-19, or you remember the Putin price hike? It was Putin price hike. And now it's corporate greed, that the corporations are making too much profit on the people. These are all the excuses that they've given us for inflation, or it's shrinkflation. We're going to talk about all this stuff right here. And it's not any of that stuff. It's not greedflation. It's not shrinkflation. It's not Putin price hike. It is the creation of money and more money in circulation. That is what inflation is. And that is why we have inflation, is the devaluation of our currency, because there is more of our currency in circulation. They keep creating more money,
et cetera, are high class problems.
Well, the number one thing that the president can do is help get COVID under control. That we know is the root cause of inflation.
President Biden this afternoon saying he thinks we're at the peak of the crisis right now and that lower prices are on the way.
The inflation has everything to do with the supply chain.
Make no supply mistake, chain. Inflation is largely the fault of Putin.
If you want
Putin
to get price rid of inflation, the only way to do it is to undo a lot of the Trump tax cuts.
Tax cuts.
Inflation rates are lower than other nations in the world.
The inflation we're seeing is due to the pandemic.
When inflation hit a new high last week, the administration and President Biden called the numbers out of date.
I just want to say a number. Zero. Today, we received news that our economy had 0% inflation.
When I hear people talk about inflation, as I heard him there, we have to change that subject. Inflation is a global phenomenon.
That's another narrative, too, is that it's global. Yeah. The dollar's the reserve currency. I would think that would have some effect on global inflation when there's more dollars in circulation. This is Biden during the Super Bowl. Talk about shrinkflation. This is a clown show. This is a clown show. This isn't Cuba, people. You don't have the president of the United States telling corporations the size of their products and how what size it needs to be and what packaging they should be using. No, these corporations are competing under this inflation the best that they can. The marketplace has become very competitive for them. And so this guy has turned into, instead of taking blame for the inflation that he caused, blaming everybody, blaming Putin, blaming Trump, blaming corporations and business. See, I mean, this is the most anti-business president that we've had in a long time. How are you going to blame businesses for making their own business decisions about the products that they want to sell, the size that they can sell them? And, shrinkflation is nothing more than inflation. And It is these corporations trying to deal with the inflation and the amount of their overhead and everything else going up. Just like on families and everyday Americans, prices are going up on these corporations as well.
It's Super Bowl Sunday. If you're anything like me, you like to be surrounded by a snack or two while watching the big game. You know, when buying snacks for the game, you might have noticed one thing. Sports drinks bottles are smaller. A bag of chips has fewer chips, but they're still charging it just as much. And as an ice cream lover, what makes me the most angry is that ice cream cartons have actually shrunk in size, but not in price. I've had enough of what they call shrinkflation. It's a ripoff.
It is a ripoff, buddy. It's your fault. Shrinkflation is inflation. That's what it is. Shrinkflation is inflation. And geez. And then this is the other one that people have been talking about too, the greedflation. Greedflation, shrinkflation. The corporations are just greedy. They're making too much profit. That's what's making prices go up. It's ridiculous. This is Joe Biden a year ago when asked directly, do you take any responsibility for inflation, Joe Biden, any responsibility?
So I'm heading off to Philadelphia. And if you want to ask me a question about the economy, but I'm not going to answer any question about anything else because you never will cover this.
Mr. President, why did you decide to postpone Secretary Blinken's trip?
Do you take any blame for inflation, Mr. President?
I take any blame for inflation? No.
Correct. Why not?
Because it was already there when I got here, man.
It's an absolute lie.
It was like when I got here?
It's a lie.
Jobs were hemorrhaging. Inflation was rising.
Inflation was not rising.
We weren't manufacturing a damn thing here. We were not
manufacturing anything here because of you, buddy, because you voted for NAFTA. You voted for every single trade deal that came across your face when you were in the Senate. You voted to offshore jobs. What are you talking about?
We were in real economic difficulty. That's why I don't. Thank you.
Mr. President,
wait. So now I don't take
manufacturing a damn thing here. We were in real economic difficulty. That's why I don't. Thank you.
I don't take any responsibility. Do you take any responsibility for inflation? I don't take any responsibility. No responsibility. I take no responsibility. What about the Inflation Reduction Act? Didn't you guys do the Inflation Reduction Act? That was almost $1 trillion on its own. The Inflation Reduction Act. When is that going to start working? When is that going to reduce inflation? I don't think people really understand how much $1 trillion is. This is a little video that shows you how much $1 trillion is. 10,000. That's 1 million, that stack. That's 10 million, that stack. That's 100 million, that stack. That's $1 billion, that stack. $100 billion. Or $10 billion. This is $100 billion. $100 billion. Look at that. I don't think you guys understand how much $1 trillion is. People, this is how big our debt is. 35 of these. 35. We're just under 35 trillion. We'll be at 35 trillion by the time summer hits. You remember this? We talked about this a few weeks ago about how fast we're adding $1 trillion to our debt, that it took 7 years between 1996 to 2002. It's 6 years to add $1 trillion to our debt. And then from 2002 to 2004, we added $1 trillion. And then now, today, we're adding $1 trillion to our national debt every 90 to 120 days. This right here is why you have inflation. This is why you have inflation, people. Let's talk about money a little bit. So I want you to look at this clip. This is a clip from 12 years ago when Ron Paul was in Congress and he's questioning Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve chair at this time. This is right after the crash in 2008. And Ron Paul is questioning Bernanke about the about gold and the rise in price in gold. Take a listen.
The price of gold today is $1,580. The dollar during these last 3 years was devalued almost 50%. When you wake up in the morning, do you care about the price of gold?
Well, I pay attention to the price of gold, but I think it reflects a lot of things. It reflects global uncertainties. I think the reason people hold gold is as a protection against what we call tail risk, really, really bad outcomes. And to the extent that the last few years have made people more worried about potential of a major crisis, then they have gold as a protection.
Do you think gold is money?
No.
It's not money.
This guy's the Federal Reserve chairman, okay? He says, no, gold's not money. The reason why he's saying as the chairman of the Federal Reserve that gold is not money is because the only thing that's money are those notes that you keep in your pocket, those greenbacks that say Federal Reserve notes. This is the only thing that this guy will classify as money is those Federal Reserve notes. So, of course, gold isn't money. You know, this is ridiculous.
It's not money. Even if it had been money for 6,000 years, somebody reversed that and eliminated that economic law.
Well, it's an asset. I mean, it's the same. Would you say treasury bills are money? I don't think they're money either, but they're a financial asset.
Why do central banks hold it?
Well, it's a form of reserves.
Why don't they hold diamonds?
Well, it's tradition, long-term
yeah.
tradition.
Uh-huh. So is gold money? Is silver money? Is precious metal money? Is even diamonds money? Mark Dice, if you don't know who he is, he's a YouTuber. He got really famous by doing these man on the streets where he would go down to Ocean Beach, Pacific Beach here in San Diego, interview people, and then put it online. This is him. He has a couple of clips where he's gone and he stands out in front of a precious metal dealer's shop. You know, he's standing like right in front of a precious metal dealer shop, and he has a silver bar and Hershey bars. And think about this, people. Hey, think about the question that we started this podcast with. Are we an alert and knowledgeable citizenry? This guy's he's standing here with a $2,000 silver bar and he's offering it to people, or a Hershey's chocolate bar, and people want the chocolate bar. They have no idea. I guess because silver and gold are not money.
By the way, this 100-ounce silver bar is worth, depending on the day and when you're watching this, it's over $2,000. A free Hershey bar, free silver bar.
I'm kind of afraid. I was always told not to take candy from strangers.
Oh, well, I'm Mark. I'm not really a stranger.
Oh,
but
okay.
You could take the silver bar.
Nah.
No?
Nah.
It is. It's 7 pounds. 100 troy ounces of silver. But well, you don't want either one?
Probably not.
No. Okay. Well, happy Halloween to me. Trick or treat. Want a free Hershey bar or would you rather have a free silver bar?
Hershey.
Hungry. Okay. Straight out of the fridge.
All right.
Happy Halloween. Here for that pizza.
A silver bar for one slice of pizza?
For the whole pizza.
It's one slice.
Oh, it's only one slice?
Only got one.
Oh. Okay.
Sorry.
Never mind.
One slice.
No.
One slice.
And like I said, this guy's made multiple videos doing this. Here's another one.
Pure silver bullion or a free Hershey's king size chocolate bar.
Take this one.
You'll take the chocolate bar. Who needs a 10-ounce bar of silver?
No.
Have a good day. It's your choice. A free 10-ounce bar of silver bullion or a free king size Hershey bar.
I think I'll take the Hershey bar.
Go ahead. It's your lucky day. Just fresh out of the refrigerator.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Who needs a 10-ounce bar of silver when you can have a good, delicious bar of chocolate, right?
So is gold and silver money? Yes, it's money, people. It's valuable because it is a scarce, precious metal. There is a finite amount of gold on the planet. It's very hard to mine and to find. And because of its scarcity, because there's a finite amount of gold, that's why gold has been money for, like Ron Paul said, for over 6,000 years. And silver has been money for over 6,000 years because it is a precious metal that it is a finite resource. It's a finite metal that you can't just get anywhere. There's not an infinite amount of gold and silver everywhere, and that's why it has been used as money for 6,000 years, because there's a limited amount. Same thing, whoever created Bitcoin, it's created with, or any of these digital currencies, it's created with the same mindset that there is a finite number of Bitcoin that you can go out and you can mine them and you can find a new Bitcoin, you can trade them, but you can't create any new Bitcoin. There's a finite amount of Bitcoin. And that's what gives the silver value. That's what gives gold its value. I want you to take a look at this clip about the Nixon shock and how Richard Nixon took us off the gold standard and when all this stuff started. It started with what is called the Nixon shock. And if you remember, we, in the podcast before last, I explained to you that Richard Nixon, born to a poor family of Quakers in a small town in Southern California, I played the clip of Russ Baker, you know, reading from his book, explaining how Richard Nixon was the creation. He was under the control of Prescott Bush and the banking and industrial elite from New York. He was their tool. Okay. So a lot of the stuff that we're dealing with now happened under Nixon. We're going to get back into talking more about Nixon and what happened in the decade of the 60s, the decade that preceded Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address and what happened in those next 10 years. Take a listen to the Nixon shock. I believe this happened in the early 70s.
In this video, we'll answer four questions. What was Bretton Woods? Why was it so important? What made the US leave the Bretton Woods system in 1971? And how did Bretton Woods cement the US dollar as the world reserve currency? To answer the first question, we must know what the gold standard is. The gold standard is a monetary system where a country's currency has a value directly linked to gold. With the gold standard, countries agreed to convert paper money into a fixed amount of gold. In practice, the central bank agrees to buy and sell gold to anyone at a fixed price. This means that a country cannot print more money without having more gold first.
The country cannot print more money without having more gold first. Because there is a finite amount of gold, then there is a finite amount of dollars. Makes sense?
Buy and sell gold to anyone at a fixed price. This means that a country cannot print more money without having more gold first. Secondly, we need to search for our history book and make a stop at the end of World War II, when the Bretton Woods Agreement took place, and we need to know some details to understand this agreement. 1. Before the US entered World War II, they served as a supplier of weapons and other goods to the
military-industrial complex, okay? This is before the United States even enters World War II. The United States enters World War II towards the end of the war, but the war had already been going on, and the United States was supplying the weapons, not only in World War II, in World War I. That's why after World War I, that's why Wilson went over to France to negotiate the Treaty of Versailles, because he was going over to negotiate all of the money that was owed back to the United States, because the United States in World War I was supplying both sides with weapons, the Germans and the Allied forces. In World War II, we were basically just supplying the Allied forces, and then we ended up getting into the war after Pearl Harbor. But the military-industrial complex that Dwight Eisenhower warns us about in 1961, they were so powerful in 1961. Like I was explaining to you, they had already taken over his administration. They had already taken pretty much taken over this country. They don't, technically take over the country until November of 1963. That's when they stage a coup d'etat in this country. But the armaments industry was very, very powerful when Dwight Eisenhower is giving that warning when he's leaving in 1961. And this is how they became powerful, by supplying weapons to all of these wars in Europe. Now, do you understand what's going on in Ukraine? You will when I finish.
1. Before the US entered World War II, they served as a supplier of weapons and other goods to the Allies, who paid them in gold. This caused the US to become the owner of most of the gold in the world by the end of the war. This made a return to the gold standard impossible for many countries, who had spent all their gold reserves buying American weapons. 2. The Allies needed to create a new system that would be acceptable to all countries. So delegates from 44 Allied nations met at a conference in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, in the United States. Its purpose was to establish a new international economic order after the end of World War II. The result of the conference was the creation of two new international institutions, the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, and the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, or IBRD, which is now part of the World Bank Group. Under this system, gold was the basis for the US dollar, and other currencies were pegged to the US dollar's value. This means that the value of a currency of a country is linked to the US dollar instead of gold.
So that's how the dollar becomes the reserve currency, if you understand that. Because the United States had all of the gold, all of the finite precious metal that we had traded weapons for to all these people to fight their wars, we had all the gold, so we pegged our dollar to the gold, and these other countries pegged their currency to the dollar. That's how the dollar became the reserve currency.
The other country is linked to the US dollar instead of gold. Countries had some degree of control over currencies in situations where the values of their own currencies became too weak or too strong relative to the dollar. They could buy or sell their currency to regulate the money supply. In the conference, among the main goals were as follows: creating an efficient foreign exchange system, preventing competitive devaluations of currencies, and promoting international economic growth.
So it wasn't until let me just go back here because
currency to they could buy
what he says the here. Dollar.
They could buy or sell their currency to regulate the money supply.
They could buy or sell their currency that was pegged to the dollar. They could buy or sell their currency to regulate the money supply. The money supply is everything. That's how you get inflation. When the supply of money is inflated, the prices are inflated. So that's why you would want to buy and sell your currency to regulate the supply. And then it reiterates it here.
In the conference, among the main goals were as follows: creating an efficient foreign exchange system, preventing competitive devaluations of currencies, and promoting international economic growth.
All right. So preventing competitive devaluations of currency. How do you devaluate currency? By increasing the supply of the currency. That's how you devalue the currency, by creating more of the currency. You devalue it.
It wasn't until 1958 that the Bretton Woods system became fully functional. Once implemented, its provisions called for the US dollar to be pegged to the value of gold. Moreover, all other currencies in the system were then pegged to the US dollar's value. The exchange rate applied at the time set the price of gold at $35 an ounce. The Bretton Woods system included 44 countries. These countries were brought together to help regulate and promote international trade across borders.
And so they set They set gold at $35 an ounce in 1958. Let me look and see what gold is right now per ounce. Gold per ounce right now is just under $2,000. Wow. What are we talking about here? We're talking about 60, 65 years. $2,000 is what gold is an ounce now. That's interesting.
National trade across borders. As with the benefits of all currency.
It's not money, though. It's not money, though, Ben Bernanke, I guess.
44 countries. These countries were brought together to help regulate and promote international trade across borders. As with the benefits of all currency pegging regimes, currency pegs are expected to provide currency stabilization for trade of goods and services, as well as financing. Thanks to Bretton Woods, the US dollar was officially crowned the world's reserve currency and was backed by the world's largest gold reserves. Instead of gold reserves, other countries accumulated reserves of US dollars. The demand for US Treasury securities was high since countries considered them to be a safe way to store their US dollars. This gave the American government an unparalleled ability to borrow money and fund budget deficits. But even this had its limits. In the 1960s, the US government's finances came under stress due to increased spending on social programs as well as the Vietnam War.
What caused all that spending? What did he just say? He says that domestic government welfare programs, the Great Society that LBJ brought us in the 1960s, and the Vietnam War. The war and the government spending is what ballooned our deficits and started to become a problem with the gold standard.
Deficits. But even this had its limits. In the 1960s, the US government's finances came under stress due to increased spending on social programs as well as the Vietnam War. This caused the United States to print more dollars to cover the deficit caused by these events. With so many dollars flooding the market and the same amount of gold available, concern grew in the international community. Other countries could not see the US backing up the new amount of dollars with the amount of gold they had, raising doubts about the stability of the currency. The demand for gold was so high that the United States President Richard Nixon was forced to take action. His following plan was called the Nixon Shock. President Nixon was concerned that the US gold supply was no longer adequate to cover the number of dollars in circulation.
It wasn't adequate. It's that it's a finite, precious metal, and there's only so much of it. So you printed all these dollars that, you know, we don't have enough gold to correlate to the amount of dollars that we have. So that's where the problem happened, because of spending on wars and welfare.
In circulation. So he devalued the value of the US dollar relative to gold. After a run on the gold reserves, he declared a temporary suspension of the dollar's convertibility into gold to keep the Bretton Woods system alive. But his actions were not received well. Nations around the world considered this as a unilateral act, so they decided on a new exchange rate, centered around a devalued dollar. This system was called the Smithsonian Agreement, where the United States agreed to devalue the dollar against gold by approximately 8.5% to $38 per ounce. Other countries offered to revalue their currencies relative to the dollar. The net effect was roughly a 10.7% average devaluation of the dollar against the other key currencies. In a few words, the Smithsonian Agreement was looking to a way to prevent the fall of the Bretton Woods system. Unfortunately, this didn't work, because speculators were driving the dollar lower and countries abandoned the peg in favor of floating exchange rates. This ultimately caused the Bretton Woods system to completely collapse in 1973, leading to a sudden devaluation of the US dollar. For example, we can take gold as a barometer of the speculative market. By 1972, the price of 1 ounce of gold was $60. Just 1 year later, in 1973, that same ounce would cost you $90.
It's not money, though.
After a month...
It's $2,000 now. It's $2,000 now, but it's not money.
Nearly all major countries depegged their currency from the US dollar, marking the end of Bretton Woods. Countries were then free to choose any exchange arrangement for their currency, except pegging its value to the price of gold. They could, for example, link its value to another country's currency, or several currencies, or simply let market forces determine its value. The Bretton Woods Agreement remains a significant event in world financial history. The two Bretton Woods institutions it created in the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank played an important part in helping to rebuild Europe in the aftermath of World War II.
All right, so that's how the we got taken off the gold standard, and we were able to just print as much money as we wanted, just continue to print dollars because it wasn't pegged to gold anymore or any precious metal. You remember what Alan Greenspan said famously. This was after he was out of the Fed, and he gives this interview. I think this is in the Obama administration, and Austin Goolsbee, who was Obama's chief economist, is here on Meet the Press. And remember what Alan Greenspan said.
The United States can pay any debt it has because we can always print money to do that. So there is zero probability.
Look at Goolsbee's face.
Of default.
There's zero probability of default because we can always
the
print
United
more
States
money.
The United States can pay any debt it has because we can always print money to do that.
So if we can always print money and just continue to print money, that means that unlike gold, which is finite, the dollar is infinite. This is what this guy's saying, that we have infinite dollars. Gold is finite, but we have infinite fiat paper dollars is what we have, is what this guy's saying. Geez, I'm pretty much done. Not done, because I have two more clips that I really wanted to share with you guys. This documentary right here, I'm not going to play the clip that I wanted to share from this documentary, but I recommend this documentary. People really need to understand where this inflation is coming from and understand what causes inflation. What causes inflation is the creation of money. The fact that we have so much money in circulation, like Greenspan said, who believes in modern monetary theory, that this doesn't matter and that you can just create infinite amount of dollars and you won't see prices rise. It's ridiculous. This documentary, The Ascent of Money, it's a 4-hour documentary. I was going to play a small clip from it. I don't have time, but I do recommend you checking this out. I'll put it in the show notes on my website, and you can watch this documentary and understand a little bit about money so you can be able to call Joe Biden and the Democrats on their BS when they're trying to tell you that inflation is caused by Putin's price hike and supply chain shortages and shrinkflation and greedflation and whatever their trick they're trying to pull on you. If you watch this documentary, you'll be able to see right through it. The one clip I am going to play, I don't have very much time, but I want to play a little bit of one of my favorite economists, Peter Schiff. And let's listen to Peter Schiff a few minutes, and then they'll play us out.
Peter Schiff warns that rising gold prices should prompt the Fed to raise interest rates if it truly follows data stating if the Fed really was data dependent, the rising gold prices would cause it to raise interest rates. Can you break this down on what you meant on this statement here?
Yeah, well, rates are too low. I mean, gold is telling you that. Right. Gold is breaking out to new highs.
To the average person, can you break down what you mean by that? Gold is telling you rates are too low. Average person listens to this, says, what do you mean by that, Peter?
Well, you buy gold as an alternative to U.S. dollars or U.S. treasuries. Foreign central banks are selling their dollars and buying gold. And why are they doing that? They're foregoing the interest that they could otherwise earn on treasuries to own a non-interest bearing asset like gold. Well, the main reason to do that is if you believe inflation is going to be higher than that interest rate, that means you have a negative yield and you're going to lose purchasing power if you stay in dollars or in treasuries. And so they are selling and they are buying gold. Look, the price of gold in the 1970s went from $35 an ounce to over $800, right? That's not a coincidence that that happened during the year or the decade of all this inflation. And what gold is doing.
Also, when we got off gold standard.
Right. But yeah. That let us print a bunch of money. But it wasn't gold that was going up. It was the dollar that was going down. Like, for example, oil prices in 1970 were about $3 a barrel. In 1980, they were $30 a barrel. But the difference was in 1970, we paid in gold. In 1980, we paid in paper. And so it wasn't that the oil price was going up. It's the money that we were using to buy oil was losing value. And so we had to pay more dollars to buy the same barrel of oil. I mean, that's why you mentioned women working. This was my comment on women, you know, in the workforce. The main reason that so many women entered the workforce during the 1970s was inflation eroded away the value of their husband's paychecks. And so because inflation caused the husband's paycheck to lose so much purchasing power, his wife had to get a job to make up the difference. Now, part of it was also rising taxes. There was a lot of bracket creep during the 70s where inflation pushed people into higher brackets. But it's not like, oh, women were just all liberated and all wanted to work. They were liberated when they didn't have to work. They got forced to work because it was the only way to pay the bills. Now, the comment I made more recently is that that's how we basically got through that time period. We had a spare laborer. We had somebody who could come off the bench onto the field and help out. And that's how families were able to survive because they now had a second breadwinner. But now you don't have that because most families, the husband and wife already work. So what are people doing now? How are people surviving this inflation? Well, look at the jobs reports that we get every month.
Second jobs.
All these jobs that are being created, 200,000, 300,000.
And debt.
What they don't tell you is these are all part-time jobs. We are net losing full-time jobs, and they're going to people who already have jobs. So people are working second and third jobs. Moonlighting is at an all-time high in America because that's the only way that people can pay the rent or,
exactly.
or put food on the table. People don't want these jobs. The creation of these jobs is not a good sign. It's a bad sign. It's not a sign of a strong labor market. It's a weak labor market. In a strong labor market, you can make it on one job. In a weak labor market, you need two or three jobs. And that's what's going on.
Tom. That's exactly what's going on. And people are going into debt. They are cutting corners, but they're picking up second jobs. They're doing the gig work. DoorDash, Uber, Lyft, to make ends meet. But the burden on people is becoming ever more burdensome. What's next is higher taxes on everyone and austerity. You're going to get less from your government. You're going to get less from your government than you're expecting and that you have paid for, talking specifically about Social Security, but there's other austerity measures that are coming. And it's because of inflation. It's because of the creation of new money, and there's more dollars in circulation, and the dollars are worth less. I'll see you guys on Monday, and I hope you have a great weekend. Thank you so much for watching and listening. If you like the podcast, please share the podcast.